session number 18463, reel 18.
Don Barrett, reel 18.
Yes, and now our shanty town was really taking shape. But I should perhaps divert here just a little bit to explain that we'd had a draft of Gloucesters from the 29 Brigade pool in Japan. Now, we had no pool at all because being a temporary brigade originally, there was no in-theatre reinforcements, so we didn't have any reinforcements. I think we'd had about 27 arrive in about October, November, but for the complete brigade, that was. And, of course, we'd had the company that had arrived just after the Nakhtong, where it arrived at three companies, and now we had our fourth. We'd been able to form our fourth, but the Argyles hadn't because of their severe losses in the fireball thing on the Hill 282. So we had four companies, they had three. Ours were, say, 100 strong companies. They had three formed companies. And we had no reinforcements. So when we lost, for example, 30-odd at Coonery, there was no way that they could be replaced. You just lost men. And we're down. I think my section is now down to four riflemen, two LMGs, and myself. Three section commanders and one second in command. The platoon sergeant is Ken Partridge, who is also a section commander, and Albert, our old platoon sergeant, who is our platoon commander. No NCOs came. No officers came at this moment of time, as far as we were concerned. They had arrived, but we didn't know this. And we got a few reinforcements from the Gloucesters. Now, they should never have been sent. They weren't fit. We had a chat with bladder trouble, and they'd been prisoners and all sorts of things. They were just the chaps who'd been left back in Japan, and hopefully that's where they would have stayed. And I understand that the CO told us later that they were so bad, some of them, they arrived in gym shoes, excuse boots bit. And he sent about 20 of them back and had a terrible time because they said, "We're doing our best to reinforce you and you're sending them back." But, I mean, it was absolutely ludicrous. These chaps weren't fit to arrive in Korea, to fight in Korea. And the ones with us were, they did their best and they were jolly good lads. But poor old Charlie Meyer, the chap who had bladder trouble, we had the occasions when we'd have to, cause you can't pee off the back of a moving lorry. I mean, didn't know that, but I know it now. And of course, we'd hang him over the back trying to wee, but he couldn't. And in the end, we had to get his water bottle and let him pee in his water bottle and pour it over the top. I mean, he should never have been in Korea. It smashing bloke, but he shouldn't have been. A chap we called Biggie, Lance Corporal Biggs, he'd been a prisoner of war in Germany. And his friend, who was later killed, he'd been a POW as well. They should never have been there. Should have. Thousands of national servicemen in England, and they sent these poor old reservist chaps out to fight. Wrong. Anyway, we had two or three joined us, and we fitted them in rather nicely into our little snug little home. And the next day after that, Elba came down and said that the CO had found a tent. I suppose they'd been having invited officers in or something. An American officer in charge of a field dressing station had offered him a tent. He said he was going to scrap it. It was torn and he didn't have torn stuff because we didn't have any big tents at all, marquees. And he said he's going with the 1500 weight down through Uijeongbu and we're going to pick up this tent. So he asked me to pick two or three guys. I picked my section. That's all we had, two or three. And we went off with him. I didn't know at this time, funny enough, that old Givem Rice, the colour sergeant, was actually going home on end of his service and that Albert was going to take over as colour sergeant. As far as I knew, he was still our platoon commander. But we went off down through Uijeongbu, completely destroyed it was. And the only thing I remember was on one side of the road there was a parachute hanging up in the trees, and I guess someone had spread it out and hung it up to make a home in it or something or other. And then on the other side of the road, the most peculiar thing, there was a coloured chap, American soldier, with a 50 caliber machine gun pointed over the railway line. I don't know why it was pointed over the road. There didn't seem to be any need for it. But it was the most peculiar thing because he had two hand grips, and presumably you could crouch down in the bottom of the trench and fire the wretched thing and direct it without poking your head over the top. I'd never seen that before. Went on through Weishanbu, which is burnt out, a few brick walls left and things like that. And suddenly the truck, the 1500 weight truck, the driver swerved. We're in the back, you'll appreciate, so we can't really see what's going on ahead. It swerved, and it swerved round. There was two drunken American soldiers rolling about in the road, arms round each other, with bottles of presumably whiskey or something or other. They were drinking out these bottles, and they were a bit upset that the lorry had swerved round them, apparently. And one of them had a 45, and he began to draw this 45 out and pointed at us, and we cocked our weapons, because if he'd shot at us, we'd have shot at him. It was as simple as that. But he was too drunk, he just fell aside, and we went on. Went down to the field ambulance, and the senior officer came out. Very nice, charming chap he was, and he showed us the tent and apologised for the tear in it. It was only just a little tear in one corner, and we had it in no time, down, packed up, and onto his onto our 1500 weight. And he came back and he said, "I can't believe this." He said, "Take my lads all day to take down a tent like that. Have some coffee." So we went over with him and had a few cups of, well, as much as we wanted in actual fact, of black coffee. Very nice. And there was a great pile of carbines there, American carbines, from the wounded and sick and what have you come in. And he said, "Well, have yourself some carbines if you like, you know." So we said, "Well, we're not really struck on them because they're not terribly good." But what we did, we picked one out, a beautiful one. It was lovely, light-coloured wood, because we were going to take it back to our hut in Shantytown, put it over the door like a hunting rifle. And we rather fancied that, and we chucked the magazine away because that didn't make it look like a hunting rifle. Took it back, and we went off back, put the tent up, no trouble at all for the colour sergeant and the cooks and what have you, quite near where they dug their cookhouse thing place. And they'd done a rather good job. They got they dug a great hole. I guess it was about 10 foot square. And they set oil drums in the bottom of this, packed earth up all round them, and they got ovens, and they were really, they'd really done a marvellous job. I suppose it was a colour sergeant who done it for them, or told them how to do it. And we put all the stores in the marquee there, and I presume they put their beds in it as well, because it'd been a natural thing. And went off back and nailed air, or probably tied up with wire, I expect, air. Our hunting rifle over the door of our little hut there. It looked fantastic up there. And we were okay now. Next day, we were paraded, and an officer turned up, John Swarbrick. And of course, the first thing he said was, "Don't try and give me any other new names," he said, "because I've heard them all. Swarbrick's the name," and just you remember it, we thought, "Oh, got a tough guy here." He was taken over from Albert, we now realise. Albert was going to be colour sergeant. And he was a bit of a formidable chap, funny enough. He was a rugby player, fairly heavily built, had big high leather boots on with sort of a gaiter on the top. BD, 29 Brigade fella, of course, come over with the reinforcements and presumably been up with the battalion commander until now. And he had a little talk with us, you know, sort of put us in our place and told us who was the boss, as you'd expect. And we were going off then to a demonstration of all arms, all with us, that was. And that was like 4-2 mortars, 3-inch, and the MMGs. And he marched us off to that, and we saw the demonstration. It was very good, funny enough. The most accurate, funny enough, were the American 4-2 mortars. They were really accurate, far more accurate than ours. And, of course, they got a fairly extensive explosive power when they burst. They were pretty good. Machine guns, MMGs, fired a few bursts up there and things like that. But I think it was a bit boring, to be quite honest. We'd seen it for real, so we didn't really want to see it demonstrated. Anyway, the company was then formed up on the road and was going to march back down the road. But John Swarbrick decides we won't march down back down the road. We'll run back. And he runs all the way back down these ridgelines through these trees. And we were absolutely sure. Nobody fell out, thank goodness. And he got us back and just dismissed us, and that was it. And we thought, by golly, we've got a tough one here. I'll say now that John Swarbrick was the best platoon commander we ever had in Korea. He was a really first-class platoon commander in all aspects, in looking after his platoon, in action when we were under fire and things like that. He was the best platoon commander we ever had. Did two tours with us, in actual fact. And we were very sorry to see the back of him. Anyway, he obviously went off then. And I presume the officers had got a, well, I know they had a marquee, which they were running an officer's mess. The sergeants had also got a marquee. And literally, they went off during the day, and we were virtually left to our own devices until we went out on a patrol or something like that. Following morning, we were formed up. The company, whole company now, was formed up. We were going out on a long-range patrol, and that was in that we would go out on transport to a point, then we'd get off, and then we'd march however far we had to go, and then come back, and the transport pick it up and bring us back. We got off the transport and started to march down a track, which was literally running down the side of the road. And if we were at the rear, a terrible place to be, because it's stop and start and stop and start, you know, you never really get going. And the track was ice covered, very difficult to walk on, very difficult indeed. Oh, it snowed incidentally overnight, and there was thick snow everywhere. And we were going along, we stopped because over on the right flank, there was going along a ridge line, was a Korean with an A-frame, that's the carrying thing they have. And he had an enormous great, couldn't make out what it was. It looked like boxes, ammunition boxes maybe. So they sent off one of the section to check and see what he was doing. And as we're standing there, there's a couple of burnt out houses on our right hand side. And suddenly, out of these houses, we see a few men, and we cover them. And a woman burst out from this group, ran up, flung arms around Wardy's neck and kissed him and was shaking her hands. And we suddenly realise this lady, she was a very well-built lady in a, I'm going to describe as a khaki boiler suit. And she was one of the people that had welcomed us when we crossed the Chung Chong River. And it was obvious at that time that she was organising everything, getting the old ladies to wave and cheer and all that. And here, we've seen her on the Chung Chong, and she's in South Korea now, with four or five rather furtive-looking men. We all had a feeling that she must be North Korean, and maybe she was up to no good. But I'll be honest, yet again, we didn't have the courage to do anything about it. She was such a friendly soul, which I suppose she had a right to be. She was giving everybody big smacking kisses and shaking their hands and thanking them for saving her and all the rest of it, you know. I don't know. She might have been South Korean, but I always had that feeling she was North Korean, and we couldn't do anything about it, because obviously if she had been North Korean, they'd have shot her straight away. Anyway, we were moving on by this time, so we didn't have a chance to go any farther with that. And we got to the end of our tour, our patrol. Quite a long way, a good many miles we'd marched along these tracks, and turned over and went over to the road, and the vehicles were parked up there. And funny enough, the cooks had come down and they'd got a brew of tea going, and we had I presume it was tea, coffee, whatever, probably coffee, but we didn't have a lot of tea. I'm sure it was coffee. And we had a good drink, and the patrol came back. They told a wild story. This chap that they'd been seen up on the ridge up there, it wasn't boxes of ammunition or boxes of any kind. It was an enormous, great wardrobe. You know, so about 8 foot high and, you know, 6 foot. And they said to him, well, what the hell are you going with this? And he said, I'm going to Pusan. And they said, but Pusan's 1,000 miles south or whatever there. And that's where I'm going, he said. And I really don't know whether to believe him or not. He'd obviously looted this thing from somewhere and was heading south with it to somewhere other. Whether he eventually ended up in Busan, I can't begin to tell. Never tell with Koreans, they go for miles. But this was an empty wardrobe. And what a funny thing to find on the top of a Korean hill with a guy with an A-frame carrying it off and saying he's going to Busan. Anyway, the transport, we loaded up on the transport and started to travel back in a good column. And we went going along there, and we were sort of hanging over the side. There was plenty of room in the trucks, no problems of overcrowding or anything like that. And the chap sort of standing next to me said, "Look down." And I looked down. I thought, "It's funny, the wheel's poking out." I thought, "Better not tell the driver, because he'll stop and we're going to be late for evening meal then. You know, we won't get our meal." So we let it go out. And in the end, it came out a metre on this enormous great spindle, this rear wheel. And I was just thinking to myself, well, I'd better, I think perhaps it's time to sort of say something, because if there's any civilians or anything walking along the side of the road, it'll kill them, it'll hit them. It's a metre out by now. And one of the platoon HQ blokes who had been looking forward over the hood there looked down, saw this thing and screamed out, and the driver put on the brakes. And we said to him, "Well, look, let's take this out, pull it out, it's going to come out anyway, shove it up in the back of the lorry and you could drive us back." But he wouldn't do that. Probably he knew more about these things than we did. And of course the column's going past us cheering and shouting and bawling, and we got left behind. And eventually a truck came out, picked us up, got us back, and the meal was burnt. We had a burnt offering, and we went off to a little shanty town again. And that night it absolutely snowed. There must have been a foot of snow. And when we got up in the morning, I was the first one up, opened the door, pushed the door open, and there was this thick snow everywhere. Everything covered, the roof, our hut, and the whole blooming lot. Fire had gone out, so we had to get the fire going again a bit quick, which wasn't too much of a bother because, you know, we had all the dry fuel inside. And I went outside the door up to where we got the LMG post. There wasn't anybody in it. I really, you know, I chose not to go too far to find out what that was. It was filled with snow and would need digging out. But as I was starting to go up to it, there was a pair of long johns all covered in muck. Went a bit farther, there's a shirt, and then a vest, and then of course a heap of mess in the virgin snow, as it were. And I knew the chap who it was, because I could see his number. All your clothing, the stuff that you'd had in Hong Kong, this was not the stuff that was being issued now. The tail of your shirt was stamped with your last four, so it might have been 7743, for example. And I went back and saw him and said to him, "What the hell's happened to you?" "Oh," he said, "I think I made a beast of myself last night with food, overeating, because we've got parcels coming in at this time, Christmas parcels." And he'd had diarrhea, and he was in a bit of a state. But he wasn't a problem, because he'd had, he got a complete set, shirt, vest, and long johns. I don't know where he got them from, because I hadn't got anything like this. So he'd done a quick change, and he left them out there. So I said to him, "Well, get out there and bury them, because, you know, you can't wash." You couldn't wash any clothes. I mean, nobody washed any clothes, because they just froze solid, and, you know, you'd have had to bring them in, and we didn't fancy anything like that over here, not in our little hut. You could, you know, washing in the morning was hard enough, because the razor stuck to your face and all the rest of it. Anyway, he sorted himself out, and incidentally, in the meantime, I tried out my shoe packs, which I got at Q&A, and I found they leaked. So I put them aside in the hut, and a chap came over to me from Platoon HQ and said, "Do you want those shoe packs?" I said, "Well, no, they're a bit cumbersome for me." I didn't tell him they leaked. So he said, "What do you want from?" I said, "Oh, I don't know. What you got?" He said, "I got a couple of American shirts, new ones." I said, "Oh, I have those." I gave him the shoe packs, and off he went. 4 or 5 days later, I came back. He said, "Here, those shoe packs leak." I said, "Well, they never leak with me." And I said, "You've had them near the fire. That's what you've been wanting." He said, "No, I haven't. I swear." I said, "They were perfectly good for me." He said, "I want my shirts back." I said, "Well, you can't. I've dished them out. They're gone, long gone." I'll mention the chap's name, had the diarrhea. He's had one. they're gone. I'm sorry you've had that. So, oh, I went off mumbling, so I got away with that, and I still kept the two shirts. And we're now, as I say, we're on central cooking. And about this time, the patrols were stopped. The rocks were getting into our area, and there was a danger that there'd be we'd shoot up a rock patrol, as the Aussies had done up at when we were up the north. So we were stopped, and I can't remember. I think it was First Cav or 24 Div maybe took over all the patrolling activity. And from I guess about the 20th maybe something like that, the patrols stopped, and we were going to hopefully have Christmas in the in this particular position. We might have to relieve somebody, but it looked as if we were home and dry. Parcels coming in, mail coming in, Hong Kong people sent us a parcel of very useful things. In fact, the most useful thing I had was a khaki handkerchief, which was very useful. Everybody had streaming colds, and a little tiny bottle of rum, and I thought, well, I'll keep that for Christmas evening. And we were doing very nicely. The food had improved. Usual meal was tinned, and it had tinned spinach, which we called Green Goddess, dreadful stuff. I mean, you had to eat it because you were hungry. But we had chops and steak and really jolly good meals. They were sort of the old American system of build you up because we're going to send you back up the front line shortly and you won't be having any of this. And it came up to Christmas, very, very cold now. And we had a really first-class Christmas dinner. The only problem was that you got it in your mess tin, you had to eat it, start eating it as you walked away, and, you know, just stand up there eating it, because if you put anything down, it froze solid. In fact, by the time you had to gobble, we were the fastest eaters in the world, because it would be freezing. And if you, as I did, I put my coffee down. I took my main meal and my coffee, and I put my coffee down, and by the time I went to drink it, there was just a little warm bit on the top, you know, and the rest of it had gone solid block of ice. And then we just washed our mess tin out. None of us had got, most of the people had got tins by this time. Mess tins had all burnt out. The tinned ones burnt out first. The solder started to float about on your meal, and the bottom fell out. And the aluminium ones lasted a bit longer, and then they burnt out. So we're nearly all on tins by this time. Tins for cups and tins for main meal. Went back and had our sweet Christmas pudding. And I think we had bread, incidentally, about this time. We'd started to have a slice of bread about every two or three days. And we ate it like cake. It was American bread. Wonderful bread it was. You didn't eat it with your meal. You just ate it separately like a piece of cake. But we were doing very well for meals at this time. And it was great. But unfortunately, there was a little incident that had happened. And I think we were probably to blame for this. 6th Platoon were probably to blame for this. Because we were in our little hut one night, all stoked up round the fire and our long johns. Incidentally, I'd looked in my long johns, funny enough. Got them down, had a look there. And all the inside, the fluff, had all fallen down. We never took them off, you'll appreciate. Any clothes off, really. And the fluff was up to just below my knee. I had a layer of fluff around my leg there, and I took it out, which was a bit of a mistake because it was presumably a warming agent. Anyway, we were in there one night, laid on the floor there, chatted and yarning and things like that, the glow of the fire. Door burst open, in came Nick and Wardy, box of sea rations. I said, where the hell did you get that from? He said, been over the mortars. They got a great pile of them there. You know, and the Americans always had more rations than we did. Or we thought they did. And they nicked this from this pile. So naturally, we dished it. There was 10 boxes in there. That's like for 10 people. And I don't know, there was about 20 of us. So we dished out all the tins and we had a real bean feast that night. Fed all the tins into the boiler and the cartons and things. So nothing was showing. Next morning when I'd got up, I'd been down to see. I knew where they'd been to get the ration box. Went down there and there was footprints leading from our hut straight the way out across past the jeep and into where the rations were. So I did a bit of quick, walking about all over the place so it wouldn't lead back to us. But of course, unfortunately, that night, having had the rations, they said, we're going to do another one. And I've got to go, haven't I? Because I've shared the rations. I've now got to pay the piper, as they say. Anyway, we did it like a proper patrol. We went out, I'm leading, got out down past, there's an American Jeep out there, and it had a brand new, I'd lost my carbine bayonet up at Chongju when it got shot out of the scabbard, and there was a brand new type of carbine bayonet, so I nicked the bayonet quick and stuck it in the scabbard and went on down. And the Americans, what they'd done this night, they'd laid in a circle like a star. They got the rations up against the tent wall, and they'd laid in a star all round it, and they got patrols out. So we been a patrol in the area, and they're all sleeping there, feather down sleeping bags, which we didn't have. And crept up to it, and I motioned them to get down, and I went forward, and stepping in between these guys, I stepped in and took a box of rations off, and slowly, because the secret of these things is to take as long as you take getting in to take getting out. The temptation is to move quick now, but you mustn't do that. You must take just as long. Crept out, gave them the rations, and they whipped off, and I followed on behind. And we've nicked two boxes of rations from them now. And I wonder if they did see us and thought probably it was wiser not to wake up. Anyway, we have another bean feast. Fantastic bean feast. The next morning, there's a parade. And company commander gets us all there, and he said, there's a box of rations gone during the night. Box of our rations has gone during the night from out of the colour sergeant's tent there, and I'm going to double the guard. And what we'd done by this time, the LMG posts have been called in, and we just got a prowler guard around the platoon area. So we doubled the guard, and he said, if anything else happens like that, I'll double the guard every night. You'll double up until you're all on guard, all blooming night long. He wasn't too pleased at all, and unless some of you own up. So we thought, well, there's not much point in us owning up, because we haven't had these. We haven't pinched airs. We've pinched from the Americans. Seemed reasonably obvious that the Americans were now pinching from us, paying us back. And we thought, well, these are good guys. These are the sort of fellas that we can sort of operate with. They treat you the same as you treat them. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the next night, another box of rations gone. Double the guard again. And it's not us. We're not involved in this at all now. It's, we presume the Americans have done it again. And every blooming night, until in the end, we had, around this tent, on every corner, there was a sentry stationary on every corner of the tent. And another one patrolling round, and two NCOs are now on every blooming night, and still these wretched botches of rations kept going. We couldn't make it out. But we heard later that we think of short reasonably confident it was the Americans paying us back, and quite rightly so, actually. But one of the platoon HQ chaps, got drunk one night. I don't know where he got the drink from, but he did, and he woke up. He apparently tried to climb the flagpole, because we'd got a flagpole with a company flag up by this time, stuck up on the hill there. And he apparently had been trying to climb the flagpole and slipped down, and he woke up frozen solid, wrapped around the flagpole. Went off back to his bivvy, because they were in bivvies, and tries to climb inside, and there's a box of rations there right in the middle. And he thought, oh my God, I'm really in trouble. He didn't put it there. Well, he doesn't think he put it there. So he didn't know what to do, so he got his entrenching tool and dug underneath his bed and buried this wretched box underneath his bed and slept on it from there until we moved. And we never did find out who was having the rations, but by Christmas Day, I'm on guard on Christmas Day with my friend John White, and we stood in the place where the cook's ovens were in the evening, 25th,